Welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started. We've had a lot of great discussion today, and tonight I think that will continue in a bit of a less formal vein. It's been wonderful to have four robust papers and responses, but we are human beings that are limited, as some of our speakers have mentioned, and so tonight we thought we would go a little different direction and have more of a conversational format. There are two purposes that we are trying to fulfill tonight. And the first is, when we originally conceived the conference, we thought it would be nice to have some time where we could talk more informally about where to go from here. Not that we're done yet, we have a great session tomorrow planned as well, but what are the prospects for engaging the culture for moral convictions, given the state of the culture, given that we are co-citizens with many who do not share either our, sometimes in case, theoretical reasoning or the practical outcomes of that reasoning. So that was one purpose. And as many of you know, we had invited Father Newhouse to join us, and he went home just recently. And so we wanted to find another time, a formal time, where we could talk about his legacy and honor him. And in fact, those two purposes fit together very well, because while I did not know Father Newhouse, I met him once, but can't say that I knew him well, I have a feeling that he would not want us to spend the entire time just talking about him. He would want us to talk about the ideas to which he was, am I right on that? Okay, there you go. Point proved. He would enjoy us talking about him, so we will do that. And that's, okay, well that's why I'm just doing the introduction, because we have with us some people that were with Father Newhouse at the very beginning of First Things, that knew him intimately, and so what better opportunity to talk about that. I also want to introduce a very special professor here at Union University, and that is Hal Poe. Dr. Poe is our Charles Colson Professor of Christian Studies, and has spent a career studying all sorts of different issues related to Christian higher education. I have the more formal thing here, which I lost my page on. He's written several books and numerous articles on how the gospel intersects with culture, including Christianity in the Academy, the Gospel and its Meaning, Christian Witness in a Postmodern World, The Designer Universe, Science and Faith, and Evangelical Dialogue, and See No Evil, the Existence of Sin in an Age of Relativism. Dr. Poe also serves as the president of the Edgar Allan Poe Museum of Richmond, Virginia. So you can see he's also an excellent partner with which to discuss these issues. So the format for tonight, I have a few questions that I will ask, and then I will get out of the way, and we will let the conversation go. And then after a little while, we will open it up for your questions. And there was no preset time limit. I think we'll probably go for a little time, but we won't keep you up too late. Then afterwards, we will go from dialectic or conversation to listening to the muse of some of our guests and their instruments. So with that said, let me start off and ask, you know, many of us know Father Newhouse from his writings, but very few of us have had a chance to meet him and spend time with him. And I know all four of you have met him in different venues, so perhaps you might want to share an anecdote or something about him that would let us know what he was like behind the pages of First Things, just as someone that you might have a heated discussion with, or sitting around over dinner or something like that. Just a memory you have of him that would give us a picture of him that we might not have seen in the back pages of First Things.
Okay. Speaking of eating, Richard John Newhouse was actually born in Pembroke, Ontario. His father was a Lutheran pastor, and he had a family cottage in De Jardinville, as it's called in the English-speaking part of Quebec. Summer cottage. It was a kind of a family compound there. And I, for a number of summers, at least for the past 10 or 12 summers, would go up there every drive up from Toronto. It was a five-hour drive. And I would bring a chest of kosher food. Richard, being the celibate that he was, never having had a wife or children, did not cook very well. And plus for the there were a lot of things I couldn't eat. So I used to bring up a chest of kosher food, and I would say that Richard, I would bring the food, and Richard would supply the liquor, the cigars, and the opinions that we were to discuss. But seriously speaking, these were wonderful moments. And in fact, unfortunately, last summer I missed it. And he actually wrote up in his column, one of his last columns and first things, that you know that I hadn't made my annual pilgrimage. But the thing that I remember was that we would be there. I would arrive in like late morning and stay till the next day late morning. And we would have these absolutely marathon discussions. I mean, to a point where I just had to kind of, you know, basically say, Richard, I gotta go to sleep tonight, you know. And but about the most, about first things, I mean, about the most serious things pertaining to God, man, and the world. I mean, his mind and his interests and his knowledge and his concerns were incredible. I don't know of any other human being in the world that I could have had that kind of sustained conversation with year in and year out. And aside from other conversations that we have, and I just want to close with this, since it's going to actually be in the next issue, which is a memorial issue of First Things, but I still hear his voice. He had a very resonant baritone voice. And I still remember in the course of our conversations, I would say something and he would say, David, you don't really mean that, do you? And he would interrogate you, whatever. And eventually, even if you did mean it, he convinced you that you shouldn't have meant it and you should agree with his opinion. But he was an incredible conversationalist. I mean, that was one of his many virtues. And dialogue is a much overused word these days, but he was an incredible dialogue partner. And I'm pretty convinced where he is now. And if through God's grace I make it there when my time comes, I certainly hope that continuing those conversations will be part of the heavenly bliss.
One of the things you learned dealing with Richard early on is the fact that you didn't dare try to keep up with him as far as the number of drinks that you were drinking. He knew how to, he could hold his liquor, and I made the mistake once of thinking I could manage to sort of keep along, and all I remember of myself is this sort of babbling. Later on, he never remarked on it later, but I learned my lesson at that point. And at one point or another, over the course of his smoking his cigars and drinking his drinks, he would come to eternal life. You know, that's if there was a sort of ultimate question, that's the question, and he would sooner or later get to that. A couple of other things that you might be interested in, and my colleagues will all second this motion, I'm sure, is he really loved to argue. He really loved to have good arguments, not tendentious, polemical arguments, but just really good arguments where differences of opinion were aired. And the first time I met Richard, he had called me this booming voice on the phone. I'd never met him. And I'm not sure I even knew who he was. I was teaching at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst then, and he had read something I'd written and said, why didn't I come to New York for this meeting? Pardon? Yeah, he may have wanted to rescue me. Why didn't I come to this meeting? And I thought, okay, well, all right. So I showed up, and there were all these really interesting and extraordinary people there, and I realized that Richard at that point had the reputation of being a conservative, but the kind of dialogue that was going on was a sort of dialogue that I had imagined should go on at universities, you know, where you really had differences of opinion and people respected one another and had these, again, really robust and interesting arguments. So it was quite refreshing because it was in stark contrast to the kinds of situations that I found at the University of Massachusetts, and also in some other groups, you know, that I'd go to a meeting and then walk away completely disappointed because there was no possibility for a serious exchange of views. And he conducted those meetings in a what would one call it, a kind of directed conversation, and Yeah, in a rather authoritative way. But views got aired in a really interesting way. Years ago, our son was at Oberlin, an undergraduate at Oberlin, and he called to tell me that Newhouse was coming to give a talk. And I said, you really have to go hear him because he's just terrific. So Eric went to this talk, and there were some protesters and some, you know, far out left folks who were God knows what they were protesting. I mean, something or another. And Eric said that after a while they were just kind of sputtering because they couldn't make any headway. You know, Richard was so incisive and so smart, and he could really run circles around those who were making kind of vacuous, stupid arguments. So I had told Eric to go up and introduce himself afterward to Richard. And our son at this point, I think it was to the point where he was wearing nuts and bolts in his ears or something. I'm not sure. He was, you know, had some kind of weird costume or another. Lord only knows what he had on that night. He favored a jacket for years. It was, you know, sort of ripped open with the lining showing. And so he may have had that on. But he went off up to talk to Richard and told Richard who he was, and Eric said that Richard looked at him with kind of a twinkle in his eye when he said he was my son and said, oh, she's one of my favorite people. And then he looked at Eric and said, I assume she's one of yours too. So Eric never got over that. He thought that was absolutely such a great moment and done with such humor. So perhaps that gives you some sense of him. He was also very, one other quick thing, he was also very caring. You know, if he heard that there was some, you know, there was some, you were going through a tough moment or something, he always made sure to get in touch and to check up and make sure things were okay. So he always took time for that.
In 1998, I was on the program with him and Chuck Colson. I met both of them the same week in Cambridge for C.S. Lewis's 100th birthday celebration. And it was a two-week affair, started a week in Oxford. And his sister was there. Did any of y'all know his sister?
Did you? Richard's sister?
Yes.
There were two sisters.
Yes, okay. Well, she was there, and she was vivacious, unassuming, and talked all along about, her brother, everybody knows her brother, and she's been in her brother's shadow all her life. Nobody knows me. Nobody pays any attention to me. And now my brother's coming, and now I've had friends, and now I won't have any friends, and on and on and on and on. So I thought, well, we need to rectify this situation. And so he came in, one of those transatlantic flights that it must have been a discount flight because he came in the middle of the night, which is hard to do going to London. Yeah. You know, that's hard to do. So, but he came dragging into breakfast, looked like death warmed over. No, it wasn't warmed over, just looked like death. And staggered to a table and sat down and bleary-eyed. And so this was my chance. And I walked over and I said, and I've forgotten the sister's name.
Joanna.
Joanna, that is. Somebody told me you were Joanna's brother. How exciting. And went on and on. It just must be something. She's got so many friends. Is it awful living in her shadow? And she was so excited the rest of the week because she'd never seen him speechless before.
As Rabbi Novak said, Richard was the son of a Lutheran pastor. And of course, for most of his career, he was a Lutheran pastor. He came from the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church, which would be the very conservative wing of the Lutheran Church. And of course, later in his life, I guess about 1990 or so, he decided that he would be received into full communion with the Catholic Church. And then he went on to become a Catholic priest. And of course, his oldest and dearest friends were within the Lutheran world. And Many of his friends were understanding and sympathetic and even supportive. There's a story behind that of why they would be supportive. There's a particular view of Lutheranism that he represented that we should probably talk about. But, you know, some were quite upset about it, and so he had the challenge of announcing to his friends and explaining to his friends why he was making this momentous move. And he had become such a powerful and important figure in the Lutheran world that it really was a significant event, his becoming a Catholic. But he told me once that the hardest thing that he had to do in connection with his becoming a Catholic was explain it to his mother. His father was long deceased, but his mother was still living. And he said that explaining his situation to his friends was nothing like as difficult as explaining it to his mother. And so he put it off for as long as he could. And finally, he steeled himself. He worked up his courage to go up to Canada and visit his mother and break the news. Now, he described his mother to me as the most self-absorbed person he had ever met in his life. That whatever the issue was that was raised, it was all about her as far as she was concerned. So he let her know he was coming and he had something important to talk about, and she was anxious about it, of course. And when he arrived, he said, "Now, Mother, we need to go sit in the living room and discuss this." And she said, all right, let's just get on with it." And into the living room they went, they sat down, and he decided he would just break it to her directly. He said, "Mother, I am here to tell you that I'm becoming a Catholic." And his mother looked at him, and she said, "No. No, that can't be right. If that's right, I could have married Vince." So Richard, has to try to figure out who Vince is or was. And of course, way back in the day, there was a Catholic boyfriend before she met Pastor Newhouse. But because of the religious difference, the thing couldn't go forward. And here, after all these years, it's not a big deal anymore, her son says, whether you're a Catholic or a Lutheran, so she could have married Vince. In the late 1960s and early 1970s, Richard John Newhouse, he always went by all three names, Richard John Newhouse, was really poised to become the leading liberal public intellectual of his day. He would be his generation's Reinhold Niebuhr, or at least that's how it appeared. And he had credentials superior to anyone else's for that job. He had marched arm in arm, literally arm in arm, with his friend, literally his friend Martin Luther King, in Selma, to other places. He was the founder of one of the most important anti-Vietnam War groups. He was a figure already, even as a young man, in elite liberal intellectual circles. He was known and would be welcomed as a speaker or participant in discussions at Union Theological Seminary and at St. John the Divine in New York and throughout the liberal establishment. Then something happened. 1973, Roe versus Wade. Abortion became something it had never been before in our history, and that was a public political issue. And Father Newhouse, although many other initially pro-life liberals collapsed as the liberal movement went in one direction and the conservative movement gradually in the other direction, we heard from Russell Moore, Dr. Moore, last night about how, you know, some elements, including the evangelical element of the conservative movement, didn't come aboard early on in the pro-life side. On the liberal side, there were still some pro-life liberals, quite a lot of pro-life liberals. Teddy Kennedy was a pro-life. Jesse Jackson was a pro-life liberal. There were lots of them. But in pretty short order, over a period of 5 or 6 or 7 years, it became clear that the liberal movement was moving in one direction, the conservative movement in another. Evangelicalism came into the pro-life movement full bore, and it became very difficult to be a pro-life liberal. Any pro-life liberal who decided he wanted to run for president suddenly wasn't pro-life anymore. Teddy Kennedy, Jesse Jackson, Richard Gebhardt, Albert Gore, you name them. But one guy didn't move, and that was Father Richard John Newhouse. Now, I think it's fair to say, and Gene and David can correct me if I'm wrong at this, that Richard enjoyed being an important public intellectual. He would have enjoyed being his generation's Reinhold Niebuhr. He would have enjoyed the approbation, the applause, as Dr. Moore said last night, of the liberal elite establishment. But he wasn't going to throw the unborn child under the bus to have it. He threw it away. He threw it away because he would not budge in his belief that every member of the human family, no matter how small, no matter how weak, no matter how poor, no matter how vulnerable, was a child of God made in the image and likeness of God to be loved, protected, cared about, cherished. So as a result of that, he cheerfully gave up the social standing that seemed to be his for the asking, that preeminent position in the liberal world, in the establishment. He gave up the honorary degrees from Harvard and Yale, the invitations to speak before the Council on Foreign Relations, the interviews with the New York Times where he would, or on the Sunday news shows where the leading liberal public intellectuals are supposed to come and give the blessing of religious approval to whatever the latest project, liberal moral project was. He gave all that up. And he had to chart a different course. He became the leading conservative public intellectual. Now, that doesn't give you many honorary degrees from Harvard or invitations to speak before the Council on Foreign Relations, but he was certainly happy and content with that because he was doing what he knew God had called him to do, which was to give witness to the dignity of human life, to stand for the proposition that all of us made in the image and likeness of God deserve respect and protection, to be part of the community of the commonly protected, as he always put it. And he saw his role, I think it's fair to say, as one of bringing people across the historic lines of theological division together to work in a shared commitment to not only the sanctity of life, though that was number one and central and had priority, but the protection of the institution of marriage, the protection of the ideals of the American Constitution, which he treasured, to the belief in equal opportunity. Not equal results, equal opportunity. He was the leading intellectual impresario of his time. He was the leading figure about Jews and Christians, like David and myself together. Evangelicals and Catholics. Russell Moore talked a lot last night about the Evangelicals and Catholics project that he inaugurated with Chuck Colson. He was the guy who reached out across those lines to say, we can work together. But you know what? And I'll conclude with this. He was never satisfied with the idea of co-belligerency in the culture war. I mean, that was pretty good. We're fighting for noble causes, and we were doing it together, but that wasn't enough. As Dr. Moore said last night, he wanted something more. He wanted full communion. Now, Dr. Moore interpreted that as meaning the Protestants cave in and come back. I don't think that's actually what Richard meant by it, but this much he certainly did mean. He did not want co-belligerency to be purely pragmatic. He wanted, and he got, he proved it could be done. He wanted what began as a marriage of convenience, fighting in a common cause in the culture war, to flower into spiritual fellowship. He wanted not just to walk arm in arm with Chuck Colson. He wanted to enter into a spiritual relationship as a Christian brother with Chuck Colson. He wanted Catholics and evangelicals across the board to do this, to enrich each other's faith, to bring the treasures of each tradition to each other. He was under no illusions about, you know, whether we'd be able ultimately to agree on all things. He was under no illusions that we didn't have profound theological differences or anything like that. But he trusted that the Lord was acting through our common cause on the great moral questions and challenges to bring us together to, in some
small way move us forward toward that end for which Christ prayed in the garden, that they all might be one. He was truly scandalized by Christian division, as we all should be. He didn't know how to snap his fingers and solve it. He knew that ultimately that's not our job, it's God's job. But we've got to get out of the way, and we have to move the obstacles out of the way of that. And we begin by working together, praying together, worshiping together to the extent that we can in good conscience with each other, and being true spiritual friends.
I just want to add one other thing, and that's just to remind you all of his book, The Naked Public Square, because I think that that looking back a few years hence, that people will recognize that book as one of the most important works, if not the most important book, of the last quarter of the 20th century on the issue of religion and politics in American life. And I think the impact of that book should not be underestimated. Some of my colleagues at the University of Chicago were by no means on Richard's side, so to speak, on many issues, but in the days following his death, a number of them came up to me and said, you know, that's such an important book, and it really made a huge difference, and they were comparing The Naked Public Square to some of the works of Reinhold Niebuhr. So I think that he was put in that company by some others.
Oh, well, through the journal First Things, not only did you have debates between liberals, conservatives, and other busts, you also had some internal disagreements that came up. And one of the most controversial was in 1996 with the end of democracy issue. And my question is, and I will perhaps start with Professor George to just give a very brief synopsis of what that controversy was. But then the question is, in 2009, is there an update on that particular issue? And just as, a little bit, this had people from the board, I believe, resigning. This was not just a left-right thing. This made a number of people that were conservative upset. How 13 years later, where do we stand on that, those issues?
Well, Richard found a way to sell a lot of magazines. That's not what motivated this particular action and created this episode, but it did end up selling a lot of magazines. In 1996, First Things published a symposium that I had the fortune or misfortune, however it may be, to be a contributor to, that had a look, had several authors, including Chuck Colson, Robert Bork, Russell Hittinger, Hadley Arkus, myself, have a look at the implications of the judicial usurpation of democratic legislative authority, democratic political authority. It was called The End of Democracy, The Judicial Usurpation of Politics. What was controversial about this within the conservative community was not criticism of judicial usurpation. And by judicial usurpation, I simply mean actions by judges, ultimately the Supreme Court of the United States, to invalidate democratically enacted legislation or policies where there is no warrant for that judicial action in the text, logic, structure, or original understanding of the Constitution. In other words, where the judges are just exercising freewheeling politics to impose solutions that they prefer, invariably liberal solutions, to disputed political issues, preeminently abortion. Now we have same-sex marriage, imposed by courts in Connecticut and Massachusetts. Perhaps it'll be imposed by other courts, perhaps ultimately by the Supreme Court of the United States. Well, Richard and the First Things folks saw this problem way back, and the question they raised that was controversial was, does there come a point at which the judicial usurpation of democratic legislative authority creates a functioning political order that is so out of line with the Constitution itself that it does not merit the consent of the people, that it loses its legitimacy, right? If we're not really being ruled under the Constitution by democratic deliberation, but are truly in effect being ruled by judges, Is that rule legitimate? Well, perhaps as a result of some unfortunate phrasing or unfortunate wording in Richard's editorial introduction to the symposium, this was interpreted by some conservative critics as a radical proposal that was based on the claim that the government of the United States was illegitimate. And so the great conservative historian Gertrude Himmelfarb, B. Himmelfarb, resigned from the board, as did two other people, saying, "I did not become a conservative in order to become a radical again." You know, she had a radical phase early in her life. She had become a conservative. She now perceived this as a kind of radicalism because it raised the question of legitimacy. So that's what the conflict was all about. David.
I'd like to address myself to that. I was not part of the symposium. That was not my department, so to speak, at First Things. I read about other things. But I remember it very well. And you mentioned Gertrude Himmelfarb, a very, very distinguished historian, along with her husband, Irving Kristol, the godfather of the neocons. And Richard and I had a long discussion about this because in his becoming a conservative, he had made alliances with other former liberals who are now called neoconservatives, a number of whom were Jews, and Jews who were not non-Jewish Jews. In other words, they were Jews. They might not have been terribly religiously observant, but they were certainly committed to Judaism as well. And the thing that I found especially distressing was when Gertrude Himmelfarb, a person whom I have great respect for both as a scholar and as a person, or personally, wrote in her letter of resignation that she recognizes no higher authority than the government of the United States. That's as high an authority as she can recognize. I said to Richard, this is profoundly un-Jewish. We Jews are supposed to recognize the maker of heaven and earth, the giver of the Torah at Mount Sinai. That's the highest authority. And the United States or the Supreme Court, when it's consistent with God's law, God's natural law, is valid. And if they really deviate from it, we might question its legitimacy. But I mean, that kind of an answer, I tried to call to his attention, I considered to be a profoundly un-Jewish answer from somebody who was not a self-denying Jew. So because of that, or due to that and other factors, I consider one of my main tasks in my relationship with Richard, both personal and at First Things, was to get him to know a group of younger Jewish religious intellectuals who were much more consistent in their commitment to the Torah and the Jewish tradition, and get them involved. And this was at times difficult because coming from the Orthodox community, the Orthodox Jewish community in North America, still to a large extent is a very sectarian kind of notion. You know, let's stay out of these public disputes unless it concerns something, like Israel or funding for parochial schools, something that directly affects us. But these larger questions of moral ecology, let's not get involved. We're gonna get burned. And if anything, I think I was helpful with Richard of beginning to bring some of these younger, that is younger than myself, which a lot of people are getting these days, into the discussion in First Things, and to make a contribution that would not ever say that the highest authority that they recognize is the United States of America, which whose authority certainly needs to be recognized, but certainly not as ultimate authority. I mean, it seems that quite clearly our commitments to the Lord God, maker in heaven and earth, and the Lord God of Israel, however our traditions understand that, is certainly what limits whether the government or the judiciary in exercising absolute power or claiming to be salvific. So this had a lot of fallout in terms of that, and I think that it was an education for Richard in terms of that he couldn't have predicted all the fallout that came. In the end, I think it was beneficial, but that's how I kind of came into it, not because I was part of the symposium.
To tell you the truth, I can't remember what I don't think I contributed to the symposium. But I did address myself to some aspect of the law and religion and politics at some point, but I don't think it was part of it. Was the follow-up. It was the follow-up. That's it.
What he did was he asked a whole lot of other contributors
that was it.
To comment on what controversy erupted.
Right. That was it. And I did not say in my commentary, I don't think I did. I may have mentioned it in passing, but I'll mention it now, that I was made a bit queasy by some of the language in his editorial, the language of usurpation and, in a sense, delegitimation. Because coming from the tradition of political theory, you know, the moment of delegitimation really, if it's to be legitimate, really comes at the end of a series, a sort of relentless series of really egregious actions to which there is no alternative. There's no possibility for pushback. And it seemed to me that that possibility still existed in the United States, and we weren't anywhere really near that point. I also thought that part of what you want to do in a democratic society is to try to build sort of strong working majorities so that you can, so it doesn't cease, it doesn't turn into simply liberals versus conservatives. You've got people coming together on certain issues that sort of high octane divisive language is maybe not the best way to do that. Although it's, you know, I don't think there's a knockdown argument about this. I mean, I think it's a matter of how you think about political strategies in part and so on. But the language did bother me a bit. And I know there were one of my good friends on the board, I won't mention her name here because I didn't ask her if I could quote her, but I know she felt the same way about some of the rhetoric surrounding this. So there was, Micah, real debate inside the journal and on the board, sort of among ourselves, about not about the importance of the issue, but about how it was presented and how it was framed.
I was really not a part of first things, and can't comment on that. I think I could say a word, though, about different parts of the country having different perspectives on the role of the Supreme Court. And in the South, Newhouse's comments in that editorial would have been considered mealy mouth, soft soap. I don't think Southerners have cared much for the Supreme Court since Madison versus, what was it?
Marbury
versus Madison. and a lot of major shifting issues, as the South itself has been changing, because remember, we have to go to racial issues and integration with 1954. Mm-hmm. And so here was this huge Southern outrage, impeach Earl Warren signs all over the South. So you had that attitude that was you'd find it everywhere. And but then in 1963, see, these are about a decade apart, the prayer in public school was a huge issue in the South. That decision hasn't quite gotten to Jackson yet. Every meeting in Jackson is opened with prayer. Doesn't matter what the meeting is. So that's part of an older culture. And then when you finally got to 1973, I think that was a furor that in 1973, I think about, I saw the statistics at one time. I've got them in a file somewhere. Something like 90% of Southern Baptist pastors were Democrats. And that's no longer the case. But 1973 was, I think, the big issue that drove that. And if I can say just one more thing about the significance of abortion, I think one of the most powerful movies that came out of the 60s in terms of affecting the way people thought about civil rights and relationships between black and white communities in the heat of the night. It's a powerful movie. It was a mystery, a whodunit, and it was full of a lot of twists and red herrings, and all of a sudden, the black man who must have done it because he was black didn't do it. But I guess you've got to throw away the movie, the plot, but the whole movie hinged on the universal disgust at the idea of abortion. Now, this was in the late 60s. Remember that? The movie depended, and the shift in attitude towards race when the mob shifted away from the black man toward the white man. If you've seen the movie, if you haven't seen the movie, you've got to see it. But Hollywood depended upon the universal repugnance of the idea of abortion to make that movie work. And that was just, less, what, 5 years before the decision, yeah.
Well, this will be my last question. So if you've been thinking of a question, or start thinking now, and you'll have a chance to ask that in a moment. You know, we've had a lot of good discussion about various traditions that are represented here, and it's sometimes said that Protestants don't have saints, but that's not true. We have one here at Union. C.S. Lewis is pretty much considered a saint, more or less, and is mentioned often in my own classes as well. And one of the things that characterizes Lewis's work was he wrote a number of straightforward, rational reason books, Abolition of Man, The Problem of Pain, philosophy-type books. But also from the very beginning of his career, he wrote imaginative works and fiction, and Dr. Poe has done a lot of work on that. And my question, you know, there's this debate that he had with Elizabeth Anscombe, and by most accounts of the debate, Lewis did not come out on the winning end of that. And however you look at it, after that point, he never started a new work of straight reason or straight rational work. It was all fiction. Now, he did that before, but after that debate, he didn't go back to that. And he once described his Narnia books as an attempt to get some ideas inculcated that might get past the watchful dragons, he called them, of the people that were suspicious of reason. So my question, which I will get to a question, my question is this. We've heard a lot about reason and its efficacy in terms of ascertaining truth. When we think about trying to influence the culture for morality and inculcating these ideas, what role do the arts and literature and popular culture play in that? We have some students here, and we want them to learn from our philosophers here at Union and Dr. Barn and other places, but would our culture be better if they're also going into movie making and book writing? So I want to actually start with Dr. Poe on that question and just ask and hear from everyone, if whoever would like to answer, but what role do these other venues of the imagination play in influencing the culture and making men and women moral?
I've been reflecting on this question before I knew you were going to ask it, but last night and today, I've been thinking just what is the difference between what I do and what the other people at this table do? And we do different sorts of things. In a sense, you rally the troops and get the battle charge, and that's not what I do. I'm more concerned with recruiting the troops. When I was a graduate student, the professor of theology was referring to his systematic theology. Systematic theology was like neuro-brain surgery. This is giving medical example. And evangelism, he says, more like chiropractor. And he was saying that about...
Okay, we're on. He was saying that about a professor who's very much concerned with... evangelism, salvation, a person's relationship to God. And he thought he was insulting the man. And the man said, well, you know, he's almost got it right. I'm not a brain surgeon. I'm more a pediatrician. Now, I left politics in 1974. I had a well-planned out career. And Bill Clinton got my presidency. But but I had a clear call to ministry that I'd been running away from for a long time. And
you got the Southern Baptist slot.
He got the Southern Baptist slot, yeah. So, I had that much figured out. But it seemed to me that what I most cared about and what was most wrong with the fabric of our culture does not have a political solution, cannot be solved by political means. Politics is still very important, but my ultimate concerns about people and the damage to our society required a spiritual solution, so I finally surrendered to the ministry and went in that direction. But I remember telling my friends before I left politics, you cannot win elections unless you have a majority of the vote. It's the strategy that was developed by Nathan Bedford Forrest. Get there first with the most. It's the only strategy that wins. And so the pulpit is a place now in our culture where you rally the troops, but it isn't where you get the troops. And you don't win people to your side by attacking them. You persuade them. You show the attractiveness and reasonableness of your position. You want them to want to be on your side. And it seems to me that the arts play an important part today in helping to convey that. You cannot use a movie as a lecture. It becomes an army training film. You know, it just bores people. And I don't think, for the most part, evangelicals have learned what to do with the arts. They haven't really tried very much. I think this is one of those dialogue moments. Mel Gibson, a Catholic, knows how to make a movie. Powerful movie. And people attacked that movie. But it was a powerful, powerful Passion of the Christ, but other movies that he makes. We need dozens and dozens and dozens of people doing what Lewis said was the best apologetics. He said, we don't need more little books on Christianity. We need more little books by Christians on every subject with their Christianity latent. And that applies to books, it applies to movies, it applies to music, it applies to poetry, it applies to every area of the popular culture, because that's the pulpit now. That's where beliefs and values are formed. And if we're not involved there, we really are have retreated from the battle.
I remember a conversation with my late friend, Christopher Lash, the famous historian, before he died. And he said one evening, we were in his home in Rochester having a conversation. He said, you know, Gene, we're winning the argument, but we're losing the culture. Pope John Paul II emphasized culture all the time in his encyclicals, in his homilies, in his conversations. My friend Cardinal George in Chicago told me that every time he went for an ad limitem visit to Rome, the first thing that John Paul would ask him was, what about the culture? You know, what's happening with the culture? So I think those are issues, in fact, I know those are issues that we have to tend to more directly. But what are we talking about? We're talking in part about formation, about the forces that are at work in our world that form the young, that help to make us who we are, how we think, how we locate ourselves in a world of others, both Christians and non-Christians, liberals and conservatives, and so on. And my worry for a long time has been that We aren't doing a very good job of thinking about how to engage the culture and how to be a constitutive part of it, you know, the salt and light idea, so that there are, like the Narnia books, there are books, there are films, they're not didactic, they're not pedantic, they're wonderful as literature. It's terrific as a film, a way to sort of bring people into, including young people, into ways of thinking and ways of being that might not have been available to them otherwise. And I say this in part because we know that that families are in trouble, not universally, but in significant ways, and that parents haven't been tending to formation in the ways in which they once did, and hopefully that's something that can be reversed. I know Robbie will say that it can, with that audacity of hope theme of his. We know that the churches have not been doing a very good job of forming people in the faith. One of my students teaches moral theology to Catholics, and they don't know the Catholic tradition. They just don't know it. It hasn't been happening in their formation and in their churches. So this formation has to go on in many places. And I think that another role that churches could play, so in addition to sort of insinuating the latent Christianity, how that you talked about, churches also, I think, could act as sort of sites of cultural interpretation and play a more direct role than they now do. I don't mean condemnation. You know, every time there's a film that you don't particularly like, you start blasting things, but of real interpretation. I mentioned this as one of, I think, the four tasks that Christians should undertake in the culture today at the end of a book of mine called Who Are We? And it is the churches as sites of cultural hermeneutics, which is a fancy way of saying sites of interpretation. So that I could imagine, you know, a very interesting session that could be held just before the Academy Awards every year, you know, Jesus Goes to the Oscars or something like that, where you would talk about the nominated films and the kinds of messages and the kinds of images and why they're powerful and why they're seductive and what's problematic. Is this a morally challenging film or is this a morally very troubling film? And I think there's a big difference between films that, in a sense, undermine morality and those that challenge our ways of thinking. So there's lots of things that can be done, but if you lose the culture, you know, you can have the best arguments in the world, and it's not going to make too much difference as far as where this country goes over the long haul. So the formation issue has to be front and center, it seems to me.
Well, I hate to be a bit of a downer.
Uh-oh.
I'm usually a very optimistic person, but, well, let me speak it this way. When I taught at the University of Virginia for 7.5 very happy years, the first, by the way, officially secular university in the United States, there were not that many really committed evangelical students at the University of Virginia, but there were some. In fact, they had a very nice C.S. Lewis society that used to have meetings, invite people to speak, and they were incredible young people, well prepared, intellectually engaging. But anyway, I had some sort of reputation at the university, and various evangelical students would find their way to my office, even though they weren't my students necessarily. And they would pour their hearts out to me, how they felt marginalized, how they felt that their faith was being ridiculed not only by their fellow students, but by their teachers, and whatever. And they would pour their hearts out, and after about a half hour, when I guess they had to come up for air, I would say to them, you know, you sound like Jews. And they said, we feel like Jews. Now, what does that mean? You see, Christians in America, and I say America, North America, are going through a painful process. You thought the culture was yours. It really never was. But you thought the culture was yours. And all of a sudden, you are discovering that in many ways, you're a minority, just like we Jews. And therefore, I think that you can learn a little bit from our experience of how we have survived in much more hostile environments than this one, and even tried to make a contribution to the society, but realized that our main task is to survive as a community. And not that we had any illusions that we were going to be the controlling force in the culture, but simply make sure that it didn't take us in and do us in. And I think that's a very painful process of re-examination that, to a certain extent, I think that we Jews can be helpful to you in perhaps showing you some ways that how we have done it under much more adverse circumstances. As I said, this was one of the main things that I did learn. Now, Richard and I had big differences about that, because Richard has a much more optimistic view of America being a Christian culture. I would certainly rather that America be a Christian culture than a pagan culture. But the fact is that it really isn't, especially in the levels of high culture, the universities, the media, the courts, and whatever. Survival is not a bad notion, as long as you're not surviving to survive. You're surviving because you have something to live for and to speak for. And at the end of the day, you should read the 137th Psalm of the exiles in Babylon. How do we sing the Lord's song on a strange ground? And that's the process that is going on now, which one of the, I think, benefits of it is it makes the Jewish-Christian conversation an entirely new reality, because there's an equal playing field out there now that we probably never had before in our mutually intertwined history. And this was something that I was discussing with Richard almost till the day he died.
That little bit of a downer from Rabbi Novak reminds me of a story that I told David last night that was told to me by our mutual friend Midge Dechter. Midge said to me once, "Do you know what a Jewish telegram is?" And I said, "No, Midge, what's a Jewish telegram?" Jewish lady. And she said, "Well, it's a telegram that says, start worrying. Details will follow." I want to give an antidote to David's downer. I want to give an upper. I can tell you this much for sure. Based on my limited experience in a secular liberal environment, live my life. If you are not playing offense, you will be playing defense. If you are playing defense, you will find yourself soon in a defensive crouch. And here is a fantasy that you should recognize as a fantasy. That if we simply give in and retreat to the monasteries, if we say, well, look, we're going to keep our little community pure, we're going to check out of the larger cultural engagement, the larger cultural debate, we're going to just keep the faith alive and keep our moral fiber together in our communities and try to keep the bad influences from coming in, they will leave us alone. We might have to give up on the culture. We might have to let them do some very bad things. You know, 1.5 million abortions a year. The demolition of the institution of marriage. We're really not talking about the redefinition of marriage. The redefinition is just the abolition of marriage, believe me. And then they'll let us alone. And then we'll carry on. You know, we'll teach our people to respect human life. We'll teach our people to respect the institution of marriage. That is a fantasy. Let's be under no illusions about this. First of all, you cannot insulate your children fully from the culture. The culture does seep in. It bears on all of us. And culture shapes conduct. And law shapes culture. We have no choice but to contend in the legal domain, in the cultural domain. Not because we like politics or want to do politics. Some of us might, some of us might not. You're talking about a situation where we're faced with pre-political challenges. We're not facing the question, Richard used to describe the question of politics in Aristotelian terms. Aristotle's gotten a lot of play here today.
as a the deliberation about how we will conduct our lives as a community together. But when you get to a question like abortion or embryo destructive research or euthanasia, which is right over the horizon, or the killing of handicapped people, you're not talking about the political question, how shall we order our common life together? You're talking about a pre-political question. Who is to count as part of the community that whose lives will be ordered together and whose interests have to be taken into account and whose rights have to be respected? We might have no taste for politics, but we have no choice but to do politics when politics addresses the pre-political questions. The state didn't invent the institution of marriage, but the state will either support it or do it enormous harm and undermine it. It's a pre-political question. Marriage is a pre-political institution. Now we find ourselves in a political situation where we have no choice but to vie for the protection of the institution of marriage. And there's a second respect in which they will not leave us alone. We cannot simply retire to the private domain and have our faith and have our moral standards. They will be coming. They will be coming with anti-discrimination laws which will be wielded as weapons to force dissenting members of the community and institutions, including Jewish and Christian institutions, and churches themselves, to fall into line. Recently on the President's Council on Bioethics, we heard a presentation from the director of the Ethics Committee of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. She left us in no doubt, presenting her report, that it was the intention of her commission to ensure that no woman was deprived of an abortion because a physician refused to perform an abortion or refer for an abortion, or a pharmacist refused to administer abortifacient drugs. She made it clear that it was their intention to make it an ethical norm, punishable by expulsion from the profession if you didn't go along, that you would refer for abortions if you were a physician or other healthcare worker, and even perform abortions where an abortion was needed and no other was available. In other words, it's the equivalent of ethnic cleansings for Christians and observant Jews who do not want to be part of the killing.
No conscience protections.
You would not tolerate conscience protection. It was just very, very clear. And notice that that can be accomplished, that equivalent of ethnic cleansing, driving Christians and devout Jews out of the medical profession, at least in this area of obstetrics and gynecology or in pharmacy, without the force of law, just by professional norms. Although, if you look at what's pending in Congress now, you will see that there are legal norms being proposed to reinforce this idea, right? What about same-sex marriage? What about sexual immorality? Well, you run a Christian school? You want to teach your children that marriage is the union of a man and a woman? You want to teach your children that sex belongs in marriage and only in marriage? Well, you can't discriminate in your hiring if a same-sex sexually active couple are involved. If they want to reveal, even to the students, what they get up to in bathhouses and sex clubs, those weapons of anti-discrimination law will be used to ensure that you get into line or go out of business. There is in New Jersey a lovely pavilion that's owned by the Methodist Church. And the Methodist Church, it's right there on the sea, on the New Jersey shore. And the Methodist Church, through the goodness of its heart, makes this available even to non-Methodist people, even to non-Christians, even to non-believers for wedding ceremonies. You can use their facility, you have to book it and so forth. You can use their nice facility right there on the sea, their pavilion. But being devout Christians, they do not permit it to be used for same-sex blessings. You know what happened to them? They've lost their tax-exempt status. Precisely because they want to live by the moral norms, the biblical norms that they believe in. And they lost their tax-exempt status not because someone put an act through the legislature, but because some tax official, a bureaucrat, sitting in a state government office, decided that their restrictions were bigotry and a form of discrimination that was incompatible with the public policy of anti-discrimination and equality of the state of New Jersey, and so she just pulled their tax-exempt status. So young people in particular, okay, we've got to be engaging the culture, on the offensive, vying for to make a prophetic witness in the public square. And I'll conclude simply by saying, while it is a horrible tragedy that we find ourselves in an era when things as fundamental and basic as Hal Poe said, wasn't that long ago that abortion was universally reviled. But we live, it's unfortunate now, in a society in which the sanctity of human life has got to be vied for, it's got to be contended for, even the institution of marriage has to be contended for, and that's sad. And I'm sad for our young people, I'm sad for my own children, I'm sad for you to be living in a world where these great blessings are not secured and taken for granted. On the other hand, did the Lord ever bless anyone in the history of civilization with the honor of working and giving witness for greater causes than these?
It may be we should just call it a night after that, but I did say that I'd give you the chance to ask a couple questions. So we have time for maybe two or three questions. I will cut it off at 9 is when we'll stop. But is there anyone who would like to, Dr. Barnard?
Do I need to approach the mic or can I stand here and follow?
I think you've got a good voice. Go for it.
Okay. I'll ask my question directly. This is to the whole panel. And then maybe give a couple words of explanation. It's an ECT question. Not so much about the document, but more about the ethos and the future of that dialogue. And my question is, what impact, positively or negatively, do you think our current two-party system and its current structure has on the future of that dialogue? Now, here's the background. I know many of you are aware of the background. I'll speak just primarily about my experience among evangelicals. Evangelicalism, as I'm sure all of you know right now, is divided probably in multiple directions. That's partly because of the nature of evangelicalism. But to oversimplify, I'll say it's divided into two parties. There are a number of leading evangelical thinkers and scholars who are pressing very hard on the idea that issues of social justice have as much weight, if not more, than issues of life and of marriage. This, of course, to the extent that it's found persuasive by many younger evangelicals, pushes them in the direction of the Democratic Party when it comes to just sort of the practical reality of politics and voting. Then, of course, you have a different perspective represented, let's say, by the editorial board of Touchstone, which says questions about means are always less significant than questions about ends in themselves. And we're talking about things like issues of life, issues of marriage, talking about issues of ends in themselves. But of course, speaking as a young evangelical, I'm deeply sympathetic to, I guess, perhaps some of the ills of the current structure of the Republican Party. And as those ills just seem to persist, they do bring pressure to bear on an evangelical who perhaps wants to defend life, yet is also concerned about issues having to do with social justice and perhaps some other things as well. So I guess now back to my question, how does the party system as it's currently set up impact the future of dialogue between evangelicals and Catholics?
I'm not sure that the party structure, I think, I'm not sure that the two parts of your question really go together all that well, to tell you the truth. I think, you know, the party structure issue is an issue that you'd have to take into account the whole political history of the country and how we wound up with a presidential system and not and a bicameral legislature, not a parliamentary system with a prime minister and so on. So you don't want to rehearse all of that. I think it's simply, we simply have to assume that we've got these two parties and that we're going to continue to have two major parties for the foreseeable future. That's just the way the structure is at this point in time. So there's that question, and that would could be adjudicated in part by, again, historical analysis and certain empirical realities. But then the other part of your question, it seems to me, has to do with the ways in which evangelicals and Catholics can make common cause and around what kinds of issues, and whether there's some inherent sort of structural problem in the Republican Party that it can't effectively address one of these sets of issues, the social justice questions and so forth. I take that to be the sort of drift of your question. And here it seems to me that we make a big mistake if we bifurcate the kinds of questions that Robbie was talking about from social justice questions, if we assume there are two sort of separate tracks. And we've got these people who are obsessed with abortion and same-sex marriage and so on. And then we've got the folks over here who really want to have health care and a more decent life and a more equitable polity and more equitable distribution of income and so on and so forth. I don't think you can divvy it up in that way. It strikes me that one problem with the social justice argument, which of course immediately puts evangelicals in a conversation with Catholics, because there's a great social justice tradition in Catholicism, even as the abortion question puts them into a conversation with Catholics. But it strikes me that it bothers me that some of those who have picked up, like Jim Wallace and others, picked up on the social justice language, that it's sort of pablum. I mean, it's sloganeering. It's kind of vacuous. And when you look at it closely, it's really hard to figure out exactly what concrete measures he and some others have in mind that are within the realm of human possibility at this point in time in American society. And I think many of the views turn on the assumption, which I think is erroneous, that those who don't agree with some major redistributive project don't care about social justice. And I think that's not fair either. The Republicans have certainly not done a very good job of making the argument that they don't disagree with the end of social justice. The question is, how do you best get there? How do we arrive at that? Do we rely on, a big state that engages in all kinds of major activities that have a redistributive endpoint? Or do we rely more on the civil society model where the state sort of serves, the other institutions of civil society rather than to dominate over them? And is that a better way to go? So the issue, I don't think, has been joined as, and you can certainly indict the Republicans for this, hasn't been joined as precisely and clearly as it should be. And I think if it were, you wouldn't have this big sort of divide that opens up between party of social justice on the one hand and the party of, sort of sexual obsession on the other, because as that's the way it's often cast. So I think you and others concerned with this issue could make a great contribution by simply recasting that and showing as well, this is one of Cardinal Bernardine's arguments and John Paul II with the culture of life argument, you can show the ways in which these issues have an interrelationship to one another. How can you wind up with authentic social justice if you're simultaneously committed to the systematic elimination of whole categories of persons? Isn't that a matter of justice as well? It strikes me it's a matter of justice to our fellow human beings who are born with Down syndrome, to acknowledge them as full-fledged members of the human community. But what does it say to them that we encourage, and there's tremendous medical pressure? I mean, all of us know couples who have even been threatened in some cases with refusal of services if they didn't abort after amniocentesis or other forms of testing, if they didn't abort the Down syndrome child. That's a social justice question, it seems to me. So I don't think we should categorize in the way that we tend to. And what it says to our fellow citizens with Down syndrome is that the world would be better off if there were fewer of you kinds of people in it. That's what we say to them. And I think that's a justice question, too. So I would just say the way in which we're sort of trained to categorize now is filled with errors, and we need to really refashion how these issues are presented to us.
Yesterday, when I'll just preface it with this remark, and then I'll try to get to the heart of your question, Justin. Yesterday, when Dr. Moore warned twice powerfully evangelical young people, particularly, against lusting for applause from the culture, if I can quote Jim Stoner, a chill went up my spine. And the chill went up my spine because Russell Moore felt he needed to warn young evangelicals against lusting for applause. And the reason that chill went up my spine is I know what happened in my community, in the Catholic community, the generation just ahead of mine, just the people who are a little older now than I am, when they had the opportunity to walk out of the Catholic enclaves, even the Catholic universities and intellectual world, and into the larger world when it was possible now to go to Princeton and Harvard and so forth. And what they had on offer, what was offered to them, was something they hadn't had before: respectability. But the offer was for a price. You get respectability in return for first muting your dissent from the liberal orthodoxy on the great moral questions. And pretty soon dissent, silence, muting wasn't enough. You needed to come along with the program, at least to some extent. Now, these years later, people of that generation have names like Nancy Pelosi and Teddy Kennedy, I can name you many scholars. All I can tell you is shun respectability, shun applause. It's a devil's bargain. And seriously, I mean this sincerely, without questioning any particular person's sincerity, I have to say that when I read some of the work by the intellectuals that you're talking about in the evangelical world and in the Catholic world as well, I can't help but wonder whether it's approval from the elite that they want. If you say, and you can get it too, it's on offer, it's there, you want it, it's yours. If you will say, look, you know, well, we still care about abortion, we still care about unborn human life, but you know what we're really going to focus on is global warming, or healthcare for everybody, or opposition to the Iraq war. I mean, you got it. You can be accepted. In other words, if you do what Newhouse refused to do in 1973, he refused the offer to be Reinhold Niebuhr. He wouldn't go along. He wouldn't accept the deal. Now, because I really don't mean to question any particular person's sincerity, just to warn against a temptation, let me answer your question more substantively. I think it's very important for us to understand the pro-life and pro-family cause in a comprehensive way. And pro-life people and pro-family people, by and large, do understand it that way. We care about the child before birth, but we also care about the child after birth. And we care about the woman who is contemplating an abortion, who may be tempted to an abortion, who may be in desperate circumstances, who may be under pressure from boyfriends, from husbands, from families, increasingly and shockingly from employers pressuring them to have abortions. And how many women, mainly women, and not rich women with a lot of time on their hands or a lot of spare resources, but ordinary women do reach out to their sisters, work in the pro-life clinics, help with the babies, help with the bills, help with the clothing, help with feeding the kids, help with getting the woman a job that she can hold while also having
her baby cared for. How many women do that? That's the evidence, if there ever needed to be evidence, of the falsity of Barney Frank's claim that pro-life people think that life begins at conception and ends at birth. I mean, that claim is proven false by the actual practical work of pro-life people. The respect for human life and respect for the institution of marriage are foundational. If we get those wrong, we will get nothing else right. You can talk all the social justice in the world. You get these foundational things wrong, nothing else can be gotten right, precisely because they are foundational. As I said earlier, in a certain sense, they're even pre-political issues. And even concretely, when you talk about, for example, the need to lift the poor out of poverty, we know, as a matter of fact, what the ultimate, the nuclear bomb against poverty is. We know it. The social science data is in. The sociologists can tell us. There is a wonderful anti-poverty program right in front of our nose. It does not have the dangers and risks of the Great Society. It will not entrench poverty. It will not be counterproductive. It will not be, it will not addict people to welfare. And that anti-poverty program is called marriage. Where marriage is healthy, poverty drops. You lose the marriage culture, what you're going to get is a lot of poverty. Why are 70% of African American children born out of wedlock today? You know, mainly in poorer inner city areas. Why is that the case? Why is there so much poverty and crime and affliction, so many people victimized in those communities? It's because there's no fathers. Bill Cosby is telling the truth about the problems in that community. He's getting a lot of grief and flack for it, but he's telling the truth. We need to rebuild the marriage culture, and not only in the African American community. When Daniel Patrick Moynihan was warning about the social consequences for poverty and crime and many other social ills, drug addiction and other things, in 1965, he was ringing the warning bell because the African-American out-of-wedlock birth rate had reached 25%. It's now 70%. At that point, the out-of-wedlock birth rate for the total population was 6%. It's now over 25%, the figure which caused Moynihan to ring the bell. If you're for social justice, and if I'm for social justice, the very first thing we should be doing is defending marriage in every way we can.
Can I just add very quick footnote to that, because I know you're all ready to hear some music, and that is that, again, there's no simple Democrat-Republican divide on this, because the domestic policy advisor for President Clinton for a period of time was a friend of ours named William Galston, who went around giving talks wherever he could on the two-parent family as the best anti-poverty program. So it's that was one of the pieces of sort of domestic thinking in the first part, the first Clinton administration, I guess you could say. I think it sort of faded away after a while. So it's this is not, again, a simple partisan divide on this. And Robbie's exactly right. The data is absolutely overwhelming. I mean, it's very, very clear. And it's amazing that people systematically choose to ignore it.
Yeah, on this question of marriage, I didn't go quite as far as when I said in terms of having lost the culture. I did not mean that one should retreat to some sectarian enclave, but just realize that being in the leaven and the dough at times means just simply being the leaven, not the whole dough, and to recognize that factor. But let me give you an example in terms of marriage where I think the approach I'm suggesting might be more fruitful. We have same-sex marriage in Canada. It's approved by the Parliament. The people in Parliament claimed that if they had voted it down, it would have been immediately gone to the Supreme Court of Canada and become a charter issue. Several, even before that happened, because we had it earlier in the province of Ontario, a number of evangelical clergy removed their names from the marriage registry, indicating to their congregations that they would officiate at Christian marriages, but they would no longer sign the marriage registry to be participants in an institution which they can no longer recognize its moral legitimacy. I suggested to Cardinal Ambrosek, who's retired now, but the former Archbishop of Toronto, that inasmuch as the largest number of Canadians who affiliate with any religion are Roman Catholic, that what would happen if the Catholic bishops removed all of the priests, all the Catholic priests throughout Canada from the marriage registry? What would happen would be is that the victory of same-sex marriage would be a party that nobody else would be attending. And what same-sex marriage is asking from the state is the blessing of the state. And if they were to simply take this seemingly retreating sectarian move, it would do more to take the wind out of the sails of those who are looking to the state for a blessing, not just to permit them, but a blessing. Then, of course, there could be a battle. And, of course, perhaps we could have an amendment to the charter, but that's very, very a remote political possibility. This is a real political act that would appear like retreat, but in the end would be not only defensive, but would have very offensive effects. So that's the type of thing that I'm talking about. But in order to have this moral influence on the culture, one has to disabuse oneself of the fact that, therefore, one has to have the old fashioned notion of a kind of dominance of the culture, and that all these other folks who are secularists and what have you are just kind of weird oddballs. They're in charge. If I want to use a gross military term, is we don't. I think we should be preparing more guerrilla action than an overall battle strategy, and that just would be one suggestion because it could easily happen here in the United States. And what if, for example, the Southern Baptist Convention took all of its clergy? I mean, if this, God forbid, I hope it doesn't happen, but I mean, if it does happen, what if the Southern Baptist clergy took all of the Southern Baptist pastors off of the marriage rolls? Let's say in Tennessee or where there's really tremendous numbers. This would change the whole lay of the land, and we would have to, and eventually have to go back to some kind of traditional notion of marriage, because those from the same-sex community, if you will want a party that others are attending to congratulate them. And if nobody comes to the party, then it's not much of a party. So that's just the suggestion. But I am not suggesting a sectarian retreat from carefully planned political action. And I agree that the best defense at times is a good offense.
We are in heated agreement.
Still here.
As to the Democratic and Republican parties, there's a sense in which our political parties are a figment of their own imaginations, and always have been. They ebb and they flow. The old joke that Will Rogers used to tell was, I'm not a member of an organized political party, I'm a Democrat. Now, the significance of that is that the unlikely can come from nowhere and wind up being the presidential nominee, which is what happened this year. The same thing happened in 1972 with Senator McGovern. Unlikely things happen, and unlikely things happen because someone succeeds in capturing the imagination of the public. And our political leaders aren't. They are followers, and that's how they survive. You have the doctrinaire, who tend to be a small group. I think the vast majority of Americans still think abortion is horrendous. I was reconfirmed in this conviction not long ago when I was having a conversation with someone in Virginia who said, I just think abortion is the most horrendous thing in the world. I just can't imagine how atrocious it is, but I can't oppose it. And his reasoning wasn't reasoning, it was emotion. It's an emotional reason, or an emotional, it's not a reason. Motive, yes. He said he had a grand old time as a young man and didn't get married until he was in his 30s. And reflecting back over the situation he put many young women in, he felt guilty. And what
were they going to do?
And that was why he does not oppose abortion, though he thinks it is dreadful. So we must not only deal with the rationality of the position, we must deal with the emotional issues connected with the position, and we must deal with the broad public in ways that the broad public can receive it. And so more than my interest in what is the Democratic Party, the Republican Party going to do, I'm more concerned with how easily we are able to use the internet and all other means of connecting with where the public live now, and helping form a consolidation, because there is safety in numbers, the critical mass, and shared outpouring of these feelings as well as ideas, I think, needs to happen in some sort of a way to help move the public back to a position that their heart and their mind are consonant. But I have great hope as well. God has not retired.
Well, God has not retired, but we may. So would you join me in thanking our panel tonight?